Here's a reading to precede Jeffrey's talk. It's called Choose to Bless the World by Rebecca Parker. Your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or curse the world. The mind's power, the strength of the hands, the reaches of the heart, the gift of speaking, listening, imagining, seeing, waiting. Any of these can serve to feed the hungry, bind up wounds, welcome the stranger, praise what is sacred, do the work of justice, or offer love. Any of these can draw down the prison door, hoard bread, abandon the poor, obscure what is holy, comply with injustice, or withhold love. You must answer this question. What will you do with your gifts? Choose to bless the world. The choice to bless the world is more than just an act of will, a moving forward into the world with the intention to do good. It is an act of recognition, a confession of surprise, a grateful acknowledgement that in the midst of a broken world, unspeakable beauty, grace, and mystery abide. There is an embrace of kindness that encompasses all life, even yours. And while there is injustice, anesthetization, or evil, there moves a holy disturbance, a benevolent rage, a revolutionary love, protesting, urging, insisting that which is sacred will not be defiled. Those who bless the world live their life as a gesture of thanks for this beauty and this rage. The choice to bless the world can take you into solitude to search for the sources of power and grace. Native wisdom, healing, and liberation. More, the choice will draw you into community, the endeavor shared, the heritage passed on, the companionship of struggle, the importance of keeping faith, the life of ritual and praise, the comfort of human friendship, the company of earth, the chorus of life welcoming you. None of us alone can save the world. Together, that is another possibility waiting. Those seem fitting words this morning to welcome our speaker, Jeffrey Ropin. Jeffrey is a young man who grew up in Oklahoma, and after getting a master's in social work from the University of Oklahoma, he moved here, our lucky day, to Portland, Oregon, where he currently lives and works as a drug and alcohol counselor. He's been practicing Zen Buddhist meditation daily for the past 8 years and has studied with Zen teachers on a regular basis. He does not officially ascribe to any religion, but considers all religions as paths to what he calls God realization or enlightenment. This morning, he will talk about his experiences of having a daily spiritual practice and how it has helped him in his current role as a social worker, and how it can practically benefit other aspects of our lives in general. Jeffrey, I'm going to let you take it from here. Welcome, Jeff.
one, check two. You hear me all right? All right. Let's get this to stay. Can everybody hear me all right? All right. Well, I have what's been rightly defined as the preacher's disease, so I'm looking to Salima once I'm starting to go a little over, so to help me out with that. I just want to say before I get going, thank you guys so much. This is such a beautiful space and a beautiful energy here, and I'll definitely be back. So I love the art. I was really admiring that when I got here. And thank you, Salima, for this opportunity. We're really blessed to be here. So I'll start out a little bit about myself. I'm currently aspiring to be an author and a musician. I currently work as a drug and alcohol counselor. I grew up in a Jewish family in Oklahoma, and my mom converted to Christianity, so as did I at that point. Eventually, I kind of left the whole religion thing and stopped making sense to me until I was going through a difficult period in my life and discovered Zen and Buddhist meditation. And that eventually led me to live at a Buddhist monastery for a while and study with teachers. And interestingly, that was kind of a doorway back into the traditions of my youth. You know, I started to see that the teachings of Christ, Jewish teachings, Muslim teachings, Bhagavad Gita, they're all really saying the same thing. And Zen was sort of a doorway back into that for me. And now I practice this type of meditation every day. Buddhist meditation. In this talk, I'm not going to get into the technical aspects of it, but when I'm referring to meditation, I'm referring to Zen and Buddhist meditation in particular. And in this talk, I'm going to widen my scope to spiritual practice in general. So that can take many forms. There's no one right way to meditate or do spiritual practice. It can take really an infinite number of forms. So the first question that people ask, and I myself am constantly asking, is you only have so much time in life, so why prioritize spiritual practice or meditation? You know, from the perspective of practical service, you know, just from what we heard up here, and we all know there's so much practical work that needs to be done in the world. So why prioritize meditation? You know, many people say it's a waste of time. Of all the things you could be doing, why would you do that? A lot of those people spend 2 hours a day on social media, but as do I spend too much time on that. But, you know, so I would answer, the first answer to that for me is that it can reduce stress. You know, at this point, there's been thousands of scientific studies done that have really proven the efficacy of meditation in reducing stress. And stress reduction is intrinsically beneficial, and in my profession as a social worker, and really in any profession, it's intrinsically beneficial, especially in the helping professions where burnout is a serious risk. And meditation, it has a unique ability to calm the mind and place the mind in the present moment. When you really calm the mind with the breath, it has that natural ability to calm the mind and allow it to rest in the present moment. And in our society, we all understand that the body needs to rest, right? You know, if you're walking all day, if you're running all day, if you're doing physical work, you understand you need to rest. And the same principle is true with the mind. If we're constantly stressed out about the future, constantly worrying about the past, constantly thinking, if that's going on, it depletes us. And, you know, from a practical level, I know in my work, if I'm trying to help other people from a stressed out, wandering mind, there's very little I can do for others if I myself am not in a place of peace. So secondly, I'd say it's a strategy to avoid becoming depleted, because when you really go deeper into spiritual practice, you can begin to serve from the source of your own being rather than from your own limited personality. And this gets into the aspect of meditation that has more to do with insight or realization than stress reduction. So I would say the insight that meditation can produce and has produced for thousands of people throughout the ages in many traditions, the insights that can be produced by meditation, they change the fundamental paradigm of service from I am a limited human being serving others out of my own sort of store of energy to I am the divine serving through this vessel. I'm not a human being seeking the divine, I'm the divine having a human experience. And that's a totally different paradigm, and if you can really tap into that in the morning before you go to work, you tap into a source of inexhaustible energy, inexhaustible love. A metaphor that I like, and that's really relevant to today's society, is it's like a cell phone plugging into the charger. If you're just using the cell phone and using it up and using it up, it'll get depleted. But if it plugs into the charger, the source of its own being, which is always present, but we're often not in tune with it. But if it plugs into the charger, there's a source of energy there. Another metaphor I like is that of the movie. You know, Paramahansa Yogananda, who was a great Kriya Yoga meditation master, he would always advise his students, when they went to see a movie, he would say, look up at the projector beam and notice that the beam of light is projecting the good guys and the bad guys. And in meditation, you make a distinction between the movie and the one watching the movie. That's why, you know, that's what that song I was just singing is about, is doing it from a state of, you serve from a state of God consciousness. It doesn't make the problems of the world go away, but you're viewing them from a different perspective. The watcher of the movie is always at peace. The watcher of the movie ultimately is not affected by anything that happens in the movie. Now, this does not make you indifferent to the sufferings of the world, but you can address them from a place of, you could say, detachment, and most importantly, of peace. And I really believe that if we are engaging in service in whatever form, if we're engaging in service from that place, it's much more sustainable. It's a sustainable way to serve the world. You know, Gandhi said, a peaceful world is full of peaceful people. Again, if we're serving the world from a stressed out, burned out state of mind, we're really not useful in the way that we could be if we were connected to the source of our being. So thirdly, and this gets back to a more practical point, similar to stress reduction, meditation actually can make the mind more effective because it eliminates extraneous distractions, and meditation produces the byproduct of a concentrated mind. A concentrated mind is not the goal of meditation. You know, you can be a tightrope walker and have a very concentrated mind. So a concentrated mind is not the goal of meditation, but it's a wonderful byproduct. And you can use this concentration to be effective, really, at anything. And in this sense, I think of meditation as a technology. You know, just how these lights that we're seeing in here are a form of technology that is far more efficient than rubbing sticks together, so I view meditation as a technology. That can help the mind arrive at a naturally calm and concentrated state. Yogananda once said that 1 hour of meditation is as efficacious spiritually as doing 24 hours of prayers and rituals, because it has that natural ability. It's a spiritual technology that can help us arrive at a calm and concentrated mind. And this concentration, the Zen word for it, the Japanese word, they call it joriki. You can apply that to anything. I apply it as an artist, as a social worker, and it actually makes you more effective at what you do. I just saw a wonderful article where I saw this picture, I believe it was in Canada, of all these police officers practicing meditation in the morning. And they were saying that, you know, when we do this in the morning, it makes us much more effective at our job. We're much more in tune with what people need, with what needs to happen. Why does this happen? Well, when you meditate, you train the mind to concentrate on one thing, which traditionally is the breath. You know, the metaphor I like is like a tiger. You're chaining a tiger to a pole. A wild tiger that's used to roaming in the forest and going where it wants. But you chain it to the pole, and it tries to go out, and you bring it back to the breath, and it tries to go out, and you bring it back. And when you do that, you build this muscle of concentration, and the mind naturally calms. So eventually, the tiger eventually lays down and basically obeys you. Your mind says, okay, we're just going to be in the present moment now. And I know for myself, as, you know, I encounter a lot of suffering during the day. I'm constantly engaged in serving people on a one-on-one basis. And when I meditate in the morning, I notice a major difference in my day. First of all, I'm in a calm state of mind. I'm much more in tune with what people need. I would say it's like driving with a clean windshield. You sort of clear out all that extraneous worry and all that extraneous thinking that doesn't really lead us anywhere. So in this sense, meditation, I believe, is very much tied into the future of religion because it's non-sectarian. Even though meditation, these traditions that I practice, they came out of certain traditions, Buddhism, Hinduism, they're non-sectarian because we all have human minds that wander. We all have human minds that can be benefited from these spiritual technologies. You know, you don't have to be a Hindu to practice yoga. We all understand that. And in a similar way, you don't have to be a Buddhist to practice Buddhist meditation. You know, I study with teachers. I have a daily practice. I go on retreats. But I don't self-identify as a Buddhist. I view this practice as a spiritual technology in my life. So it's a non-sectarian thing. And also, when you get into, as I said before, tapping into the source of our own being, that sort of thing, those insights, the insights that meditation can produce, I believe are also non-sectarian. You know, Ramakrishna, who was a great Hindu master in the 1870s, he has influenced me in many ways. He referred to God consciousness, which is what I call it in my book. He referred to God consciousness. He described it as, it's like the taste of water. And every language has a word for water, but yet the taste of water is the same. When someone asked Ramakrishna, what is God? He said, the pure mind is God. Basically, he's saying, your own awareness is God. Your own natural, true nature, your awareness. There's a Zen master, a student once came to him and said, what is the Buddha? And he said, ordinary mind is the Buddha way. Ordinary mind is the way. He said, your own mind. And how did Ramakrishna and the Zen master, how did they arrive at this insight? It's through their spiritual practice. And again, it gets back to changing the paradigm from I'm a human being seeking the divine to I'm the divine having a human experience. And I also believe that this same insight, that our own natural state, our own natural awareness is itself God consciousness. You find that at the heart of the Christian tradition as well. You could really call it any word you want. You could call it Krishna consciousness, Christ consciousness, Buddha mind, the Tao. Lex Hickson, who's a spiritual teacher I really admire, or was, rest in peace, he defined God consciousness as the open space of awareness beyond all religion. That's seeing me right now and hearing the sound of my voice is always present. And meditation is a doorway into this. It's a direct doorway into this. And again, serving from this place of insight, serving from this place of God consciousness is infinitely more sustainable than merely trying to help the world from my own sort of limited personality. And this gets into the fourth reason I have here to practice meditation, which is the intrinsic happiness that's based on insight. So this gets into the more religious or spiritual aspects of meditation that go way beyond stress reduction and concentration. So as I said before, concentration, having a calm, concentrated mind is a byproduct of meditation, but it's not the goal of meditation. So you could say the goal of meditation is enlightenment, which is not a thing that I gain. It's an insight into what's already present, a deeper insight into the awareness in this moment that is already present. And you could define enlightenment or this insight as happiness itself. So being connected to the source of our own being is an intrinsic goal in itself. Because what else are we doing here, right? If the goal is not to find happiness, you know, what else are we doing here? So being connected to the source of our own being is a goal in itself. In fact, you could say it's the goal of all life. And I believe this happiness, which is not a feeling, it's the realization of who we actually are. And this happiness, I believe, cannot be found in any other place. You know, you can't find it through altruism. You can't find it in human relationships. You can't find it in money. Even though these things are wonderful, you can't find true lasting happiness in them. You know, one of my favorite metaphors of that is the Ramakrishna metaphor. He said, the life cycle of the human soul is like a child in a room full of toys. And it plays with this toy and that toy, and it goes through all the toys one by one, and then it gets tired of playing with toys. And then it cries out to its mother, and the mother comes and embraces it. So it's a metaphor for, you know, we often get the mentality, maybe I'll try to make a lot of money and let's see if that makes me happy. Maybe I'll try to get in a relationship and see if that makes me happy. What if I try to be famous? You know, in Ramakrishna's view, we do this for lifetimes upon lifetimes. And eventually we realize, oh, happiness can only be found in the source of my own being. Happiness can only be found in connecting to God consciousness. And again, when we come at the world from that place, there's a peace that can be found. So no matter what's happening in the world, there's a part of me that's, again, present right here. There's a part of me that's always at peace. And in meditation, I'm able to tap into that to greater and greater degrees. Of course, there's no limit to the depth with which we can tap into that. My favorite way to put it is the Zen teaching, which calls our true nature, again, you could call it Christ consciousness, God consciousness, Bob, I don't care. But whatever you want to call it, there it is. And I like the Zen teaching, which calls it whole and complete lacking nothing. You are whole and complete lacking nothing. When I have a client who's a heroin addict or a meth addict and their life is falling apart and they're sitting down in front of me, that's the first thing I think. I think this person is whole and complete, lacking nothing. Maybe not in their human personality, maybe not in the movie, but in who they really are. Whole and complete, lacking nothing. In the Bible, you find the Apostle Paul talking about the peace that passes all understanding, which is whole and complete, lacking nothing. So to bring this back to service, to be in tune with this truth through meditation, it's not escapism. I would say it's service from a place of completion rather than a place of limitation. It's service, you could say, from the source of love. Instead of loving people, I become love. I'm one with love. Or as Christ said, I and the Father are one. You know, there's many ways to describe this insight. You know, I was on an airplane recently and they said, fix your own oxygen mask before helping someone else fix theirs. So I am always asking myself, how much can I really be of service to anyone else? Can I really be of service to anyone else if I am not at peace within myself? That's why above my desk I have the proverb, physician, heal thyself. I say I can't help anybody unless I first am at peace within myself. So, and I'm going to end with this. This brings me to, I call it the central dichotomy of the spiritual path, or the seeming dichotomy. And so I'm going to kind of broaden the discussion here to religion in general. And the central dichotomy of the spiritual path is the balance between connecting to the source of our own being and then from that place serving others. And it's a balance that we all must find. And both aspects are necessary to live a balanced and authentic spiritual life. And it's the balance between finding a connection to God consciousness, and then serving humanity. And I believe that this balance is expressed in all the great religions. So in Christianity, you find Jesus going into the desert to meditate, pray, do his spiritual practice, and then out of that place, coming to help the poor, to heal the sick, to serve the world. In Judaism, you have the two great commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and love your neighbor as yourself. In modern lingo, we could define that as connect to the source of your own being. Connect to the source of love within yourself through spiritual practice. And from that place, serve humanity. See, you can't have one without the other. In Buddhism, you know, you have the Buddha's solitary practice, his meditation practice, where he was alone in the forest practicing meditation for many years. You have that eventually blooming into 40 years of service, tireless service to humanity as a teacher. In the Bhagavad Gita, the sage Krishna would practice meditation in the morning and evening, yoga meditation. But he was also a prince, and in the day he would attend to his duties and serve humanity. In Islam, you have Muhammad. He would go into the caves of Mecca, or the cave outside of Mecca, and would engage in some form of meditation on Allah, the source of being. And then from that place, you know, he channeled the Quran and really served humanity in a very unique and tireless way as well. So these great examples from religion, to me, they show me that spiritual service is different than mere altruism. A Hindu would say that it's the difference between merely working and serving and karma yoga. Karma yoga is a term used in the Bhagavad Gita, which refers to serving humanity from God consciousness. Yoga means to yoke. Serving from the place of union with God. It's not the same as merely serving, merely working. So in Jewish lingo, we could say that if we try to fulfill the second commandment without the first, we can't really fulfill either. So if we try to serve humanity without first connecting to the source of our being, it leads to burnout and frustration. So, and conversely, if we are only engaging in spirituality to find maybe an inner peace, to connect to God, but then it doesn't express out in practical service to humanity, it's really useless. In a certain way. And it's not the full expression of the spiritual path. You have to have both. It kind of leads to a selfish, Americanized, maybe New Agey form of spirituality that doesn't actually express itself outward in the world. So many people hear these suggestions, and they hear about these religions, and they hear about these different paths, and they ask, well, what do I do? What do I practically do? I mean, these are all just ideas. So that, to me, just to draw to close, you know, it gets back to the idea of meditation being a spiritual technology that someone of any religion can engage in. On the one hand, to reduce their own stress, to arrive at a calm and concentrated mind. And on the other hand, to connect to the source of their own being. You know, there's one of my favorite verses in the Bible is a psalm that says, "Be still and know that I am God." Now, the funny thing about that verse is if I heard that from God, I would basically say, well, how the heck do I do that? You see the mind you gave me? So we need a way to do that. Meditation for me is that way. You know, Martin Luther King once said, Jesus gave me the message, but Gandhi gave me the method of nonviolent resistance. And so for me, I could say, these religions, the Bhagavad Gita, Islam, the teachings of Christ, they gave me the message, but Buddhism gave me the method. It's a practical way that I can actually integrate these states of awareness into my own life. And I believe it's something that many people need in our society. This type of meditation, because firstly, it's non-sectarian. Anyone, you can be an atheist and do it. You can be a member of any of the theistic religions and do it. And secondly, it's just a practical way to reduce stress, as I've been saying, and we're such a stressed out society in general. And And lastly, it's a practice that is based on experience rather than blind faith. And I think many of us are just kind of tired of the blind faith thing. So anyways, these are some thoughts on this whole topic. It's obviously a vast topic. And I do want to briefly mention, before I open it up to questions, that I have a book called Daily Bliss, Practical Ways to Experience God in Everyday Life. And I've got some copies downstairs if you're interested, where this is sort of the full expression of what I'm talking about here. How do I integrate this into my life? How do I have a meaningful spiritual practice in my life? And of course, there's many, many, many infinite answers to that, but this is just kind of what works for me. So as I said, my cup runneth over in terms of the whole talking thing. I could go on infinitely to the detriment of my friends and family. So I'll open it up here to questions, if anyone, or comments.
I will bring the mic around. If you'll put your hand up, we can start here and kind of go around.
Thank you, Jeffrey. That was really interesting. Plus, it has this real feeling of being sent to me because I've been looking for a book. And a friend and I were looking at your books downstairs, but we didn't know how much they cost.
Five easy payments of $49.95. I think
what did you call
$10
today?
$10.
Thank you so much for this talk. So many things in it I just resonated with, and one of the things you said that Buddhism gave you the method.
Yes.
And that was what attracted me to Buddhism. It's a method.
Yes.
And a lot of people have messages. And the one thing that I have trouble with, it's probably my upbringing or whatever, is the word God. So I always stumble. I just stumble. It's like I'm on hit a rock.
Right.
And so through the door that Buddhism opened for me, this is how I think about it, that I am the universe aware of itself. Which is another way of saying exactly what you've been saying, but it leaves out the word God. So anyway, I just thought I'd mention that if anybody else has a problem with that word. I'm sorry, but I do.
Yeah, I think this gets into my view on what has to happen with religion itself, is that we don't necessarily need to abolish religions, but we have to redefine them in light of our own scientific civilization, in light of our own sentiments. So the word God, I use that word in an identical way that you would find in a Taoist teaching of the Tao, or in a Buddhist teaching of Buddha nature. Really, I'm referring to the nature of our own awareness when I use that word. And so, yeah, it's not something that we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but I think religion is a dynamic process, and we can redefine these things, and we have the right to, and even the duty to. These ancient truths have to be expressed in the light of our own time. That's very beautiful that you had that experience with Buddhism.
I have both a question and a statement. Meditation to me is very often when I walk a familiar place.
Mm-hmm.
I get back to where I started, using my home, and I don't really know how I've got there. I've done the whole thing without, unless somebody says, hi, Charlie, or something that way, I'm just all of a sudden there. And then the other thing is, this is a statement that I need an explanation that I think you made. Whole and complete. Lack of nothing.
Lacking nothing.
Mm-hmm. I still don't understand it. What am I not understanding about that statement? Whole and complete, comma, lack of nothing?
Lacking nothing. With the ing.
Okay, lacking.
Yes.
I'm not understanding.
Well, to me, what that's pointing to, you know, they say in Zen, one of my favorite Zen parables is that they say all the teachings are like a finger pointing to the moon. And we get lost in the finger without looking at the moon. The finger is just a springboard into seeing the moon. And you could say all the teachings of all the religions are finger pointing to the moon. And really, in Zen, it's talking about our own true nature or our own awareness. It's the part of us that is always perfect. It's always at peace. Remember I was saying there's the movie and then the one watching the movie, you know. So, again, it's not saying that the world is okay and we just need to be laissez-faire about it and pretend there's not suffering people. But there is a part of us that's always at peace, and the great spiritual masters have testified to that. And what I like about Zen is they say it's not in some afterlife. You know, you don't have to die to experience it. It's not the exclusive property of priests or some holy beings. It's your own nature. It's your own awareness. Seeing me and hearing me, and that's what it's pointing to. And that awareness that we are, is whole and complete, lacking nothing. Whatever happens to the body or my personality, whatever happens in my life, that aspect of me is always at peace.
I have maybe a practical question. Can you give an example of a time in your work where you either have applied this knowledge that you shared with us, or after you've been through a certain experience at work, you realize how different it was or would have been had you not engaged in this practice? You know, some kind of like, how did it affect the outcome, I guess?
Right. So as a counselor, I mean, I often will give meditation practices to people who are going through a lot of deep suffering. And I just noticed that teaching them to calm their own mind really has a massive benefit for them. And especially if someone's going through deep emotional pain, to be able to calm the mind and to hold that emotional pain in the light of awareness. You know, my teacher will often say, drop the story, feel the feeling. And to really be able to do that and to learn to hold your own feelings with compassion, that, I believe, especially in drug and alcohol counseling, because when people are going through deep emotional pain, what they'll tend to do is go out to the drug to numb it. You know, there was a great Zen teacher who said, the way out is in. Meaning I am engaging with my own emotions, and that meditation, I believe, is a very powerful way to do that, and I teach that to people at my work. And I know for myself, I mean, when I'm really engaging with person after person after person after person, it kind of gets into me, and I need a way to clear that out. So I'll go into the back office and meditate for 10 or 15 minutes, and it really helps me. It kind of like resets me for the next person. I honestly, you know, this may sound like a facetious thing, but I could not do this job without my meditation practice. So I just couldn't do it.
Jeffrey, thank you so much.